Blog Talk Radio.
Broadcast of 2017 of The Cross in the Desert, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. I'm your host, Randy L. Noble. So very, very glad to be back with you once again. It seems like it's been an eternity, but it's only been about a week and a half, and I have been so preoccupied at work. You know, I have two jobs, one full-time and one part-time, and with the holiday season, have just been overwhelmed, and of course, being with the family. And so unable to come to you live. I've been playing some former programs that are important, don't get me wrong, just not filling time with those. But it is great to be back with you live, and I want to welcome everyone today to the first broadcast of The Cross in the Desert in 2017. We have a lot of things to talk about today, but I want to mention just in passing here, this broadcast is near and dear to my heart. Every year, I just rededicate and reaffirm my commitment to be a voice of hope and freedom to my Iranian friends. And they certainly are suffering. There is no change. There has been nothing that has changed in their situation, but I never give up hope. My trust is in the Lord that He will change their circumstances, that one day, through a series of events, the world will wake up to a regime change in Iran. Now, to some of you, that may seem so far-fetched, and you may think that could never happen, but our great God can do anything. Nothing is impossible for Him. And as we look at what's happening in the world, I am very, very encouraged that in just 18 days, we are going to see a brand new president, and Mr. Donald Trump, president-elect, gives me so much hope for our economy, for our military, for everything that the Obama administration for the last 8 years has destroyed in so many ways. And so I look forward to in 18 days seeing a new president inaugurated, and I believe he's the real thing, if you will. I believe he will stand by what he claims he's going to do, and we will hold him accountable. Make no mistake, we will hold him accountable, but I believe he's a man of integrity and that he will do exactly what he says he's going to do. And so I look forward to that event. Today on the Cross in the Desert, I have some sober, depressing news. I have to start out with this. But it's something that's a reality for my friends in Iran. And today I want to talk to you for the first couple of minutes about Arash Sadaji. Arash Sadaji is in prison, in Evin prison right now, in the hospital. He has been on an ongoing hunger strike since October. Today is day 71, and lack of water has literally caused his kidneys to contract. And it's very dangerous because it means the next step in his condition is that his kidneys will fail. Now, you may say, what good is this doing? Well, a lot of Iranian prisoners go on hunger strikes, and it does make a difference in some cases. In this particular case, the prison has agreed to a bail, a conditional bail, that both him, that is Arash, and his wife Golrakh, will be released on Tuesday. But in particular, because he's in such failing health, it would be his wife that's released. Now, Arash went on this hunger strike to protest the imprisonment of his wife and of himself. And he said, I vow to not come off it until we're released. Well, the news I got on Saturday was that there was an agreement to a bail, which was hopeful. But the problem is Arash's conditions. 70% of his right kidney has been damaged. The other kidney, the left, is damaged at 20%. And reports from the doctors on scene say his right kidney is so damaged it will never return to his normal functionality. He has also severe intestinal adhesion. What that means is it can result in internal bleeding if his health continues to deteriorate. And an official report warns of the possibility of his death. It's imminent. His life is in real danger. And so a source told Human Rights that his health has deteriorated so much to the extent that his body is now rejecting water. He was actually taken to the hospital prison in Evin because he was vomiting blood. And so it's very severe. In fact, as we speak, up on my Facebook page, if you go to my Facebook page, you will see a video of protests and rallies outside of the prison. Hundreds of people have gathered in front of Evin prison demanding the release of Arash and his wife, Golrakh Ebrahami. A group of mothers of other political prisoners are among the demonstrators. They're holding pictures of Arash and Sadaji up there. And security forces, of course, tried to disperse the crowd, but the crowd is growing. Again, this is day 71 of the hunger strike. Now, here's a statement by the head of Evin prison. He told Arash, I will not let you get out of this prison alive. Arash, I want to tell you a little bit about him, was a student of master degree of philosophy at Alamah University. He was denied education because of his activities. He was arrested several times between 2009 and 2014. And finally, recently, he was charged with propaganda against the regime, assembly and collusion against national security, and his sentence was 19 years. His wife, Golrakh, was sentenced to 6 years on charges of insulting the leadership and writing, get this, an unpublished article. She had an unpublished article when they went into Arash's house to seize his computer. They found an unpublished article she had written against the inhumane punishment of death by stoning. And she was arrested, but the article had never even been printed. And so what I'm asking you to do is to stand with me. Go to Twitter with your hashtag and put the little hashtag up, Save Arash. Whatever you would like to do, but Save Arash is the basic hashtag. Join Kaveh, my good Iranian human rights activist, and Miriam Azdi, my other good friend. They have been so busy up on Twitter drawing attention to Arash, doing a great job of gathering support. So if you can, in your busy schedule, please go to Twitter, hashtag Save Arash. Let's get this information out there. Let's do everything we can to call on this regime, this government, to demand them to release Arash and Golrokh, and let it be very, very soon, because Arash is near death. I will keep you posted on my page. Beyond this radio broadcast, I will let you know the latest update, but right now on my page is the story of Arash, the radio broadcast, and the video taken outside of Evin prison. And so again, here it is in 2017, and this vicious cycle of imprisonment continues. To any Iranian that dares to raise their voice in protest, to any Iranian that dares to speak out and to dare to challenge this government for the inhumanity that they do to people. And so, once again, just join with me today in speaking out for Arash and Golrokh and praying for them, most importantly. That is very, very important. I believe that God answers our prayer. I believe he cares for the oppressed. That is my badge. That is my commitment to my Iranian friends, is speaking out and praying. Well, speaking of just inhumane things, I want to take us to a story that actually is on my Beyond the Veil page and my Tears in the Bottle page. And it has gotten a lot of resharing, a lot of hits, a lot of viewing, and I can understand why. When you hear this story, you will understand exactly why it has gotten so much attention. This is the story of a Muslim father who executed his 27-year-old daughter in Cleveland, Ohio, and it's been called an honor killing. This happened back in the fall, but it is a horrible example of just how honor killing is so active and prevails here in the United States. You know, you think of Pakistan, you think of Afghanistan, you think of Saudi Arabia, and yes, it happens there, but honor killing has been going on here for several years now and is continuing to increase. This is a story from The Political Heat by Dan Adams, and what I want to do, because it's so important for you to understand what's going on, I want to read this story word for word to you. A Cleveland man who admitted he fatally shot his 27-year-old daughter at his family's suburban home has been indicted in her death. A jury charged Jamal Mansour, 63, with murder, aggravated murder, and felony assault on Wednesday in the September 27th slaying of his daughter, clinical pharmacist Tahani Mansour. She had feared him for years, according to friends of the victim from her medical college. Prosecutor Michael Osei said in court days after her death that her father, quote, essentially assassinated his own daughter, Your Honor, with gunshots to the head, not one, but two. And this was reported initially by the Cleveland. Jamal Mansour, who owns several retail businesses around northern Ohio, told police he shot his daughter in her bedroom at their Rocky River home because he was angry after an argument. He later told the judge the shooting had been an accident. Yeah, right. Mansour's lawyer declined to comment this week, pointing to an earlier statement he made about his client. This is what he says. Mr. Mansour is a good man who very much loves his family, lawyer Angelo Leonardo did. Well, obviously, he shows a lot of love and compassion, right? Now, officers in Rocky River, Ohio, a suburb 9 miles outside of Cleveland, had gone to the family's home way back in December 2012 after a call saying Mansour was threatening to commit suicide, according to a police report. His wife told police, quote, he was very upset about his daughter's trip to Las Vegas for a conference. Her friends and colleagues confirmed his daughter, the youngest of six children, had been attending a national conference in Las Vegas at the time. Tahani Mansour, she graduated in 2013 from Northeast Ohio Medical University. Philip King, her classmate and friend from the Doctor of Pharmacy program, remembered her commitment to her education, how much she enjoyed socializing with friends, and her beauty. Her family was, quote, very, very protective of her, King said, unquote, remembering her devotion to the medical program. Quote, it seemed to me like it was almost an escape, he said. King thinks she may have tried to hide her 2-year relationship with a classmate from her family. She once told King she was afraid of her father, although he said he didn't question her further about the situation. "I didn't ask," he said. "I knew there were cultural reasons." Now, Tahani Mansour completed her residency at a medical center in Gogna and later served as a clinical pharmacist at Huhuja Medical Center, and she had recently been hired at the Cleveland Clinic, which is a world-renowned nonprofit academic medical center. Now, friends of her posted on the Society's Facebook page that she took the nickname Tahani Bunny after a patient struggled to pronounce her name and asked if that was right. She and a colleague often held what they called desert offs, vying to see who could eat more. "As I grew to know her personally, I learned what an extraordinary heart she had for her friends, family, and the pharmacy profession." One person wrote, "She was full of life and energy, and her memory will be everlasting on the many people she impacted." Now, her father remained jailed Friday on a $4.5 million bond. A judge increased it from the original $1.5 million after prosecutors said he had recently returned from Jerusalem at the time of his arrest and had a place to live out of the country. Again, this is just so tragic. And if you see a picture of this beautiful pharmacist who had just began her career just very recently at a prestigious medical center, just go to my page, Beyond the Veil and Tears in a Bottle. It's also on my Facebook page. And please continue to share it. This one news article has been shared numerous times, and I'm so happy for that. This story needs to be told. Again, some of us may want to know why a father could even stoop to such horrible behavior. In the mindset of Muslim-dominated countries, there is a cultural norm that the family, that is the daughter, the son, must do everything that the parents say. They must bow to the wishes of the parents. Now, I wrote a book recently called Prisoner of Her Culture, Sakina's Fight for Freedom, which talks about this mindset. And it's a book that talks about Sakina, who is a young Muslim girl. She's growing up in a deadly culture of acid attacks and honor killings. If a young girl who is a Muslim has friends that are non-Muslims, who begins to dress in a way not consistent with Islam, who begins to wear makeup or take off her hijab or post it on Facebook, or has any relationships outside of the parents' restrictions, this is the result. This is the result. A great documentary called Honor Diaries talks about this issue. There are Muslim women on there who are activists speaking out against honor killings. It's a great, great documentary. You really need to watch that. But I want to just try to explain to you why this young, beautiful girl suffered and was killed by her father. Because in his mind, her behavior, her career, her associations is dishonoring to Allah. It brings shame to the family. And when a woman does this, they consider it bringing shame to the entire community. And so the only repercussion that is suitable is death. And this is how a Muslim woman is treated. I don't know the extent of her beliefs, whether she had departed from that, but according to her father, her lifestyle was unacceptable. And so the horror of honor killings continue. And something needs to be done about the laws in certain countries so women are protected. In Pakistan, it's egregious, but there is some progress. You can go to my Beyond the Veil page. There's articles of women who are starting to receive real protection from this brutal kind of treatment. And so I can't say enough about my conviction of how wrong this is. How absolutely wrong it is. It's not just a matter, folks, of culture. Many, many Muslims will say this is just a cultural thing. But that's no excuse for abuse. I think it goes beyond culture. I think it's their religion. And I think that's the whole reason and the motivation for this beautiful girl that was killed this past fall. What I want to do now is I want to turn our attention to a subject that is very prevalent in the news. And it's once again an example of the anti-Semitism in the world today against the Jewish people in Israel. And it's once again an attempt to legitimize a two-state Palestine-Israel separation. And Palestine has no intention to holding any kind of peace treaty. But just recently, the Obama administration refused to vote no against a resolution that condemned the settlements of the Israelis beyond the West Bank. And in doing so, they have opened up Israel to sanctions, to more terrorist attack, and to more dishonor. And it is a snub against Israel as Obama leaves the White House. He wants to create a scenario that Trump will have to face Russia and also the scenario with Israel. And once again, this is another example of the Obama's administration refusal to support our greatest ally in the Middle East, which is Israel. They're the only seat of democracy left. And once again, this is an example of how the United Nothing, and that's what they are, refuses to recognize Israel's sovereignty, their land, and this has so many implications. What I want to do is I want to go to several reports on this resolution. I want you to hear from former Ambassador John Bolton to the UN, the Israeli Ambassador Oren. I want you to hear this report right now on the cross in the desert. Let's listen.
Israeli government officials and Palestinian officials are already responding to this move in the United Nations Security Council. Let's go to Oren Lieberman, CNN's correspondent in Jerusalem. Oren, what's been the reaction in the region from the Israeli government, from the Palestinians?
Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was furious about this resolution, and he is still furious about this. Here is the statement his office put out just a short time ago. It says, Israel rejects this shameful anti-Israel resolution at the UN and will not abide by its terms. At a time when the Security Council does nothing to stop the slaughter of 500,000 people in Syria, it disgracefully gangs up on the one true democracy in the Middle East, Israel, and calls the Western Wall, quote, occupied territory. The Obama administration not only failed to protect Israel against the gang-up at the UN, it colluded with it behind the scenes. Israel looks forward to working with President-elect Trump with all our friends in Congress, Republicans and Democrats alike, to negate the harmful effects of this absurd resolution. There, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu making it very clear he's done working with Obama and is already ready to start working with Trump, already giving a hint as to what his reaction to the resolution might be when he says it will not abide by its terms. Perhaps we can expect the Israeli government to continue building in settlements in the West Bank as well as building in East Jerusalem. Meanwhile, as can be expected, Palestinians celebrating this resolution. They've worked on it for a long time. They tried to introduce it back in 2011. Obama vetoed it then. He abstained now, allowing it to go through. Celebrations among the Palestinians. Here is a statement from the Palestinian presidency's office and his spokesman, Nabil Abu Rudena. It says, the UN Security Council resolution condemning Israeli settlements in the Palestinian territories and claim to stop it is a big slap in the face for the Israeli policies and a strong support to the two-state solution. Perhaps predictable, these reactions we've seen. Israelis condemning this in the strongest terms we've seen, the strongest criticism of the Obama administration, the Palestinians hailing it as a major step towards peace.
All right, Oren Lieberman in Jerusalem, thank you so much.
It's amazing to me that Obama had any support from the Jewish community. I recognize there's a lot of Jewish communities that are not Orthodox, and they are so taken in by the democratic promises. But look at what they do. They betray their own people. They betray the nation of Israel. So the Jewish community, I hope for the most part, will awaken and find out that President-elect Trump is a true friend of Israel. And I know that Netanyahu is very excited about the friendship that Trump will have with the nation of Israel. And I look forward to it as well. Now, former ambassador to the United Nations, John Bolton, was recently on the Hannity program, and he had some reaction to this non-vote on the resolution allowing it to pass. Let's listen to former Ambassador John Bolton on the Hannity program.
Welcome to Hannity. President Obama stabbing Israel in the back on his way out of office. I'm Eric Bolling in for Sean tonight. Former U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. John Bolton is fired up and will be here in just a moment with reaction. But first, in what many are calling the ultimate betrayal in America's alliance with Israel, the Obama administration earlier today allowed the United Nations to pass a resolution condemning Israeli settlements in East Jerusalem and the West Bank as, quote, a flagrant violation of international law. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is reacting by saying, quote, Israel rejects the shameful anti-Israel resolution at the UN and will not abide by its terms. Netanyahu adding, quote, the Obama administration not only failed to protect Israel against this gang up at the UN, it colluded with it behind the scenes. And President-elect Donald Trump is responding by tweeting this, quote, as to the UN, things will be different after January 20th. Here now with reaction is former U.S. Ambassador to the UN and Fox News contributor John Bolton. Thank you, Ambassador Bolton. Wow, big day at the UN. So tell us, do you think that the UN Security Council colluded with the Obama administration to bring this vote today?
Well, I think certainly the sponsors of the resolution, the Egyptians, some of the others, some of the five permanent members of the council, including Great Britain, obviously had to consult with the Obama administration to tell them what was in the resolution so that it was sufficient for Obama to order an abstention. The United States could have killed this resolution by voting no. It did vote no on a very similar resolution in 2011. But this was, and you said it exactly right at the top of the show, this was a stab in the back against the Israelis. It was entirely predictable. I would say this for people in the pro-Israel community in the United States who defended Obama's Middle East policy over these last 8 years, that you should have seen this coming, and this is what you get for supporting Barack Obama.
Yeah, and this is a shot, I guess, this is at Israel, but also President Obama had a pretty contentious relationship with Benjamin Netanyahu.
Well, I think it goes beyond the personal. I really think this was an effort to box the incoming Trump administration in, and it violates nearly 50 years of American bipartisan policy on the Middle East, going back to the iconic resolution 242 after the 1967 war, which established the principle of land for peace. This resolution says basically Israel's occupation is illegitimate, therefore it has no land to give back in exchange for peace. Contrary to what the Obama administration has said, this puts a huge thumb on the scale against Israel. It does go to final status. It does affect Israel's security. It undermines it in profound ways. The consequences of this resolution are going to be felt for many, many years, all negative on Israel and substantially negative on the United States itself.
And let's
Well, and that's the former ambassador to the United Nations, John Bolton, explaining the impact, explaining the consequences of abstaining from this vote. Earlier, they had voted, that is the Obama administration, no, but it was conveniently left to chance, if you will, and he walked away from any support of Israel by not voting, and therefore these are the ramifications, the consequences of a non-vote. I want you now to hear from Israeli Ambassador Oren, who's going to articulate a little bit more about what's involved with not standing up for the Israeli people for not voting no and killing it, but instead by abstaining, the consequences are mammoth. And this was done on purpose, as stated, because Obama loves his legacy so much, and he wants everyone to see how wonderful he has been as a president. Of course, he hasn't, but his legacy is so important in his own mind, in his narcissistic mind. But he wants to leave Trump with this conundrum between Russia and then with Israel, but it's going to backfire completely. So I want you to hear now from Israeli Ambassador Oren. He was on the Judge Jeannie Perini show just a few days ago. Let's listen.
Welcome to Hannity. Tensions rise between the U.S. and Israel after the Obama administration betrays America's closest ally in the Middle East. I'm Judge Jeanine Pirro, in for Sean tonight. The fallout continues after the Obama administration failed to veto a United Nations resolution that declares Israeli settlements in East Jerusalem and the West Bank a, quote, flagrant violation of international law. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu continues to condemn the Obama administration for the unprecedented move. Take a look.
American administrations and Israeli governments have disagreed about settlements, but we agreed that the Security Council was not the place to resolve this issue. We knew that going there would make negotiations harder and drive peace further away. And as I told John Kerry on Thursday, friends don't take friends to the Security Council. I'm encouraged by the statements of our friends in the United States, Republicans and Democrats alike. They understand how reckless and destructive this UN resolution was. They understand that the Western Wall isn't occupied territory.
President-elect Donald Trump is throwing his support behind Israel and tweeted out, quote, "The United Nations has such great potential, but right now it is just a club for people to get together, talk, and have a good time." So sad. Joining us now with a reaction is the author of Ally, Deputy Minister for Diplomacy in Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu's office, Ambassador Michael Oren. All right. Hello, Ambassador. Thank you so much for being here this evening. Can you tell us why Israel was so deeply offended by this resolution?
Good to be with you, Judge. We were hurt. We were outraged by this appalling resolution. Understand, this resolution labels over 500,000 of our citizens criminals, violators of international law. As the Prime Minister Netanyahu said, it takes our holiest places, the Western Wall, and labels them illegally occupied territory. The resolution exposes us to sanctions and boycotts as Palestinians and others will try to use this resolution as a basis for suing us in international criminal courts around the world. It's a greater threat than the missiles fired at us, because we can believe that. It's a terrible, terrible move. And it sends a horrible message to the world about what America cares about, what the UN cares about. About 2 hours from where I'm sitting and talking to you here, Judge, is Syria, where over 400,000 people have been butchered. 5 hours east of here is Iraq, where tens of thousands of people have been killed in a civil war. 3 hours south of here is the Sinai, where there's a civil war against ISIS. An hour and a half of here is Hamas. And all these millions of people are calling out to America and the UN, help us. And what does America and the UN do? They beat up on the only democracy in the Middle East.
All right, Ambassador.
Think about
that. Is Judge Jeannie Pereiro and Michael Oren, Israeli ambassador, talking about this resolution, which we've been sharing here for the last 15 minutes or so. It's important for you to understand something. I was looking at a video. And it was a video of the American bald eagle. It was the mother giving birth to little eagles, if you will. And it was a video provided by Fox News. Well, now, the American eagle is an endangered species, the American bald eagle. But what does the American bald eagle stand for? It stands for us as a country. It's the symbol of our country. And so it is a protected species. It's illegal to kill an eagle. You can face some very serious consequences with the law. But that is a symbol for us, the American bald eagle. Well, in the same way that the American bald eagle is a symbol that we protect here, Israel is our greatest ally in the world, and we should be able to protect them from their enemies, protect them from terrorism. Now, I understand the Iron Dome that protects them from missile attacks was courtesy of us. But the point of the matter is, when it comes right down to it, with what's happening in the Middle East, with the terrorism at the highest level of threats it's ever been, this is the time we should reach out to our greatest ally and support. And in fact, I go one step further. From a Christian viewpoint, the Bible is very clear about the status of Israel. From a Christian viewpoint, they are God's chosen. They have a special standing, if you will, with God. Now, that may sound a little bit strange to some of you Christians, but understand this. When Israel became a nation again in 1948, it was the fulfillment of Bible prophecy, very clear. I know there are some Christians that would disagree with that. And I understand that those Jewish people, for the most part, in Israel are not converted. And they are spiritually dead, if you will. They have not become Christians. And this gets into a whole different scenario of teaching about Israel and the church. And I'm not going to go into that right now, but on later programs I will. But what I want to say about Israel, our greatest ally, is that we have a responsibility. The Bible is clear in Genesis chapter 12, in God's covenant with Abraham. He says, I will bless those who bless you, Abraham, and I will curse those who cursed you. The nation of Israel, the Hebrew descendants, was with that original covenant God made with Abraham in Genesis 12. And the point being that there is a responsibility that you and I have. God says he will bless those who bless you, and he will curse those. He will stand against those that curse you. And that's very important to my heart as a Christian, that we support Israel. And to do so, we need to be educated about what's going on there. And I found about a five-minute soundbite that is going to help you and me to understand a little bit more about what's going on there in Israel with the Palestinians. What is the truth about all of this chaos, this conflict, if you will, that goes on daily that we hear about? The media seems to be steeped in anti-Semitism and always will take the side of the Palestinians. Well, why is that? What I want you to do is take a couple of minutes with me. I want you to hear this short educational soundbite about the truth about the name Palestinians and what's going on in the Middle East. Let's listen.
We often hear these historical claims about the Palestinians.
منذ 5000 سنة والفلسطينيون في هذه الأرض.
سيدنا المسيح عليه السلام هو فلسطيني بامتياز.
In a highly politicized debate, it's worth asking, what's fact and what's fiction? The name Palestine was created by the Roman Emperor Hadrian. During his rule, Hadrian massacred the rebellious Jewish population in the Kingdom of Judea and sent most of the remaining Jewish population into exile. Hadrian was determined to obliterate thousands of years of Jewish presence in the land of Israel, going back to the time of the Bible. Archaeological evidence demonstrates a continuous Jewish presence beginning in 1300 BCE. And so, he decided to rename the province of Judea, Syria Palestina, after the nemesis of the Jews, the Philistines. The Philistines were an ancient people that, like many others, had vanished over time and have no connection to today's Palestinians. While Hadrian exiled many, the Jews have maintained a continuous presence in the land of Israel ever since, building strong communities in Jerusalem, Safed, Hebron, and Tiberias over the years. Judea was the last independent state that existed in the land. Century after century, the remaining Jews, as well as other groups, lived under the rule of successive foreign empires that called the area by different names. But in Europe, the Roman word Palestina remained the geographical term that was used most frequently. So when the land fell into the hands of the British at the end of World War I, they named it Palestine. The League of Nations, a predecessor to the UN, granted the victorious World War I powers mandates to control the Middle East and prepare the local peoples for independence. This area came under the British Mandate of Palestine. Two populations lived under the Mandate of Palestine, Arabs
Salam.
And Jewish.
Shalom.
While the Arabs, for the most part, preferred to see themselves part of Greater Syria, the Jews adopted their new association as residents of Palestine. And so, the Jewish-founded Palestine Symphony Orchestra would, upon Israel's independence, become the Israeli Philharmonic. The Anglo-Palestine Bank would become the Israeli Leumi Bank. And this poster, that is often used today to support anti-Israel arguments, was in fact a Zionist ad promoting tourism to the Jewish homeland in Palestine. In 1947, the mandate expired, and the UN decided to split the land into independent Jewish and Arab states. The Jews accepted the UN resolution and called their state Israel. The Arab world, however, rejected the two-state plan, and right after the last British soldiers departed, attacked their newly independent neighbor. They wanted to eradicate the Jews in Israel. Against all odds, the Jewish people in Palestine, without a regular army or an air force, were able to defeat all of the Arab armies who came to destroy them. After the war, Jordan annexed the West Bank, and Egypt took over the Gaza Strip, both areas that had been assigned to the Arabs as part of the partition plan. Neither country saw a need to set up an independent state in these areas. As a result, an Arab state did not materialize in the former British Mandate of Palestine. In 1964, the Arab League founded the PLO, Palestine Liberation Organization. This was the first time this Arab group, that previously defined themselves as Syrians and Egyptians, started naming themselves the Palestinian people. The PLO demanded the entire area of the Mandate, though it called for the destruction of Israel, but did not challenge Jordanian and Egyptian rule. Arab aspirations continued to focus solely on eliminating the State of Israel and killing all of the Jews who lived there, instigating another war in 1967, in which Israel gained control over the former Mandate territories in the West Bank and Gaza. So, are these historical claims about the Palestinians true?
لم تمر حقبة في التاريخ خلت من وجود الشعب الفلسطيني في هذه الأرض.
السيد المسيح كان الفلسطيني الأول الذي عذب في هذه الأرض.
No, these claims are false. The name Palestine was only created in 134 AD, and the Arab population that lived in Israel during the British Mandate only started calling themselves Palestinians in 1964. But what about Jesus being a Palestinian? Jesus, in fact, was a Jew living in the Kingdom of Judea.
Well, there you have it, a little bit of education, because that's what we need today, because the media is tainted with a bias against Israel for Palestine. It's very anti-Semitic. And so I figured that the only way we're going to get at the truth, we're going to have an understanding, is we have to go to the right sources, the right conservative sources. And this has been an ongoing struggle for the Israeli people, for the Jewish people. And you always have these different scenarios with the PLO. We remember Yasser Arafat and the PLO. This whole scenario is painted with one aim: to destroy Israel. The Arabs believe Jerusalem is their holy city simply because there was an event years and years and years ago with Muhammad. The night journey took place in Jerusalem, and they believe that that is their right to that city based on an event in Muhammad's life as Islam was progressing. This is the claim by the Arabs, that this city belongs to them. And so the radicals want to do everything they can to delegitimize Israel as actually being a people that has anything to do with that land. And so the claims that the Palestinians have been around for thousands of years is an illegitimate claim, and I hope that helps you understand that. What I want to do, I want to go to the Bible. The Bible has a lot to say about the future of Israel and Jerusalem. And I understand this is a very controversial topic, and I understand there's extremists out there that say things that aren't scriptural or biblical. And I've done my best to only listen to those balanced teachers that understand scripture and understand prophecy. They're not extremists, they're balanced, and they have good insight into what goes on over there. And I'm referring to a man named Jimmy DeYoung. He is a scholar, an author, a journalist that lives in Jerusalem. The Jewish people are very good friends of him, and this is a subject near and dear his heart. He's been a guest frequently on the John Ankerberg Show, and I wish we could just dedicate a whole program to his teaching. But what I want to do is I want you to hear a couple of important sound bites to understand what's going on in Israel, to understand the background, and most importantly, what the scriptures teach about the future and what's going to happen. This first sound bite is explaining this conflict with Hamas and Israel, and it gives you a little bit of background. Let's listen to it right now on The Cross in the Desert.
Let's go back and summarize some of the things that we are seeing in the news and tie these to biblical prophecy. Let's start with Israel and Hamas, the conflict, the war that's been going on there.
John, that's been going on for a number of years in present history, but it dates back some 4,000 years ago to the time when two brothers, twin brothers, Jacob and Esau, were born to Isaac and Rebekah. In their mother's womb, they started to fight. The Lord told Rebekah that was going to be the case throughout all of history. Two states would come out of her womb. If you chase through history, biblical history, you see that Jacob became the Jewish state of Israel, and Esau became what we know as the Palestinian people. Never has been a Palestinian state. They claim there has been, but that is not truth. And they want to have a Palestinian state, and that's a part of this conflict that's continuing on. It's going to continue until Jesus Christ comes back. They have a ceasefire today. They don't have a ceasefire tomorrow. They fire a couple of rockets. The Israeli F-16s go in, attack those sites which are firing those rockets. So as we're on this broadcast right now, the ceasefire may be on, it may be off. We just don't know because it's changing almost from day to day. But it's a conflict that's going to continue. And Hamas has a charter. It's an Islamic radical organization. It's an outgrowth of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. That charter calls for the leaders and the people of Hamas to wipe Israel off the face of the earth and replace it with a Palestinian state. And they have stated time and time again, the only way that's going to be able to be accomplished is through an armed struggle. And so you have Iran arming Hamas. You have many other terroristic organizations financing what's going on in Hamas. You have them being held up by Qatar and other organizations. Even the Saudi Arabians have sent money in, some of the people individually, not the nation itself. But Saudi Arabia has to be on the side of Hamas, even though Hamas would be considered radical Islamists. So this is not going to go away until the little book of Obadiah is fulfilled, which says, when Jesus steps back, that'll be the end of the conflict.
Now, there you have it, some background information. And this idea of a two-state solution, you can tell that that's unworkable. There's going to be no peace. In fact, they've stated in their charter, Hamas says the only solution is not a two-state solution. It's the utter destruction of Israel and the establishment only of a Palestinian state. What I want to do now, I want to read to you from the Bible, Ezekiel chapter 38, because this sets up the next soundbite I want to play for you. I want to read to you from the New Living Translation, Ezekiel 38, a message for Gog. This is another message that came to me from the Lord, Son of Man. Turn and face Gog, of the land of Magog, the prince who rules over the nations of Meshach and Tubal, and prophesy against him. Give him this message from the sovereign Lord. Gog, I am your enemy. I will turn you around and put hooks in your jaws to lead you out with your whole army, your horses and charioteers in full armor and a great horde armed with shields and swords. Persia, Ethiopia, and Libya will join you too with their weapons. Gomer and all its armies will also join you, along with the armies of Beth Togarmah from the distant north and many others. Get ready. Be prepared. Keep all the armies around you mobilized and take command of them. A long time from now, you will be called into action. In the distant future, you will swoop down on the land of Israel, which will be enjoying peace after recovering from war, and after its people have returned from many lands to the mountains of Israel. You and all your allies, a vast and army, awesome army, will roll down on them like a storm and cover the land like a cloud. This is what the sovereign Lord says. At that time, evil thoughts will come to your mind, and you will devise a wicked scheme. You will say, Israel is an unprotected land, filled with unwalled villages. I will march against her and destroy these people who live in such confidence. I will go to those formerly desolate cities that are now filled with people who have returned from exile in many nations. I will capture vast amounts of plunder, for the people are rich with livestock and other possessions now. They think the whole world revolves around them. But Sheba and Dedan and the merchants of Tarshish will ask, do you really think the armies you have gathered can rob them of silver and gold? Do you think you can drive away their livestock and seize their goods and carry off plunder? Therefore, son of man, prophesy against Gog. Give him this message from the sovereign Lord. When my people are living in peace in their land, then you will rouse yourself. You will come from your homeland in the distant north with your vast cavalry and your mighty army, and you will attack my people Israel, covering their land like a cloud. At that time in the distant future, I will bring you against my land as everyone watches, and my holiness will be displayed by what happens to you. All nations will know that I am the Lord. This is what the Sovereign Lord asks. Are you the one I was talking about long ago, when I announced through Israel's prophets that in the future I would bring you against my people? But this is what the Sovereign Lord says. When Gog invades the land of Israel, my fury will boil over. In my jealousy and blazing anger, I will promise a mighty shaking in the land of Israel on that day. All living things, the fish in the sea, the birds of the sky, the animals of the field, the small animals that scurry along the ground, and all the people on earth will quake in terror at my presence. Mountains will be thrown down. Cliffs will crumble. Walls will fall to the earth. I will summon the sword against you. On all the hills of Israel, says the Sovereign Lord, your men will turn their swords against each other. I will punish you, and your armies will disease and bloodshed. I will send torrential rain, hailstones, fire, and burning sulfur. In this way, I will show my greatness and holiness, and I will make myself known to all the nations of the world. Then they will know that I am the Lord. This is Ezekiel chapter 38 in the New Living Translation. I want you to hear prophecy scholar Jimmy DeYoung explain this passage in light of current events and what will happen in the future. Let's listen to that right now.
And Jimmy, as a journalist, you've covered the Middle East since 1991. And as you look at what's happening in the world and what the Bible is teaching about what happens after the rapture takes place, when Christians are out of here, Ezekiel 38, we've been talking in past weeks about specific nations that God says are going to form a coalition and come against Israel. And we've been saying some of those nations are on the horizon right now. We can see this shaping up. Finish this up. Summarize what Ezekiel 38 is talking about in terms of future events, because it'll tell us how close we are to those.
You know what's interesting when you study the book of Ezekiel? Those last 16 chapters, after the Jews come back into the land, there's going to be an alignment of nations that are going to come against them and try to wipe them off the face of the earth. For about 8 years when he was president of Iran, Ahmadinejad continually said, we're going to wipe the Jewish people off the face of the earth. And he would talk about their name being forgotten forever. The Ayatollahs, the ones who control the nation of Iran with the Supreme Council, these Ayatollahs who are really the leaders of Iran, those men that are out front as president, they're the face of Iran, but not true leadership. But they said, we can wipe Israel off the face of the earth in 90 seconds. In fact, when Ahmadinejad was making those radical statements, I looked at Psalm 83, verse 4, where the Lord tells in Psalm 83 through this prophet that indeed nations will come against Israel. They'll have a council meeting. They'll come out of the council meeting, and their statements will be, we're going to wipe Israel off the face of the earth, that her name be forgotten forever. Folks, as we sit here on the sidelines, as we look towards the region of the Middle East, that's exactly what we see happening. We've talked about Iran on the first program. We emphasize how key Iran is and their development of a nuclear weapon of mass destruction to not only threaten Israel, Saudi Arabia, the Middle East, but the entire world. And the world is watching this come to pass and really not doing anything to deal with Iran. Now, Iran is not the leader of this coalition of nations. They're a major player. Russia is the leader. Magog, chapter 38, verse 2 of the book of Ezekiel. And Gog in the land of Magog. Now, I don't know that we can say who Gog is. That's the personality. The place is Magog. That's Russia. And the Old Testament in Genesis tells us that's the location that Russia is, where they went some 4,000 years ago to develop a family. Then we saw that Turkey was going to come in and form this coalition, be a part of it, to come against the Jewish state of Israel. This is all unfolding before our very eyes. Tayyip Erdogan wants to be the pan-Islamic leader of the world. He's, in fact, the other day he said, hey, you've got to reinstate Mohamed Morsi as president of Egypt. So he's formed an alliance with the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood, they were the major players standing on the sidelines when Libya and Colonel Gaddafi was taken down, and then they rushed into the vacuum to be the key component in putting that Libyan government back together. When you go over to Syria, the Muslim Brotherhood, they've been the underlying objection to Bashar Assad being president. They've helped form this coalition. You see the Muslim Brotherhood over in Jordan. They're trying to bring down the king of Jordan, King Abdullah, down and put a radical Islamic state right there. You look at all of these nations, they're forming together. The lowest common denominator, they're Muslims. They're of the Islamic world, maybe with the exception of Russia. But you better be studying the demographics of Russia, because they're quickly moving into that place where they're going to have many Muslims, an Islamic population across the world. You have to go into Sudan, Ethiopia, Somalia. You go over to Lebanon in chapter 83 of Psalms. It talks about Tyre. That's modern-day Lebanon. It talks about the Ishmaelites. That's modern-day Saudi Arabia. And you see all of these nations forming this coalition with one common goal: take Israel out of the picture. Wipe them off the face of the earth, that their name be forgotten forever. Isn't that ironic? You got 5 to 6 million Jewish people in this little piece of real estate, less than the size of New Jersey. You have 350 million Muslims around them, and they're wanting to wipe out this little state. God said it was going to happen. We're moving quickly to the time when Israel will lay down their weapons. They'll be defenseless. They'll be living in unwalled cities, a military terminology in chapter 38 there and verse 11. And that's after the Antichrist comes on the scene. He puts in place a so-called peace agreement. It's going to be a pseudo peace, a false peace, but he'll come to power. And Israel and all of her neighbors will agree to it. Israel lays down their weapons. In comes this alignment to try to wipe them out. Joel chapter 2, verse 3 says, the largest militia ever formed on the face of the earth will come to Jerusalem to try to set up their caliphate, a worldwide kingdom. Islam has an eschatology. It's different, of course, than what the Word of God talks about. But after the rapture that Rennie has so well been talking about, this seven-year period begins, and in the first 6 months, this alignment of nations will come to try to wipe out Israel. That's the greatest evidence, I believe, that we have that we're living in the times of the rapture and then the period of the tribulation.
Jimmy DeYoung, outlining Ezekiel chapter 38, I highly recommend that you read this on your own, consult some good commentaries. Sometimes the footnotes in Bibles aren't always accurate. But this has been thoroughly researched, and I find that other people would agree. Joel Rosenberg, another great author who writes a lot of Christian fiction books about the Middle East, many, many good scholars would agree that Ezekiel chapter 38, Magog, is referring to Russia. You can see this before your eyes. We are living in a very exciting time, and prophecy, to me, demonstrates the accuracy and the reliability of the Bible as being the authentic Word of God, unlike any scripture anywhere in the world. So I hope this has been educational with you today. I hope that you will do two things. Pray for the Jewish people. Pray for the peace of Jerusalem. They need our prayers. They need our support always. I want to turn us now to an exciting part of the program. When I do 90 Minutes, I always like to include the latest music from contemporary Christian artists. And today we have a delightful representative. His name is Phil Wickham. He's a 32-year-old contemporary Christian musician, singer, and songwriter who's from San Diego. He's released 9 CDs, and he has been a force of great Christian music for a long time. And what I want to do, I don't want to take a whole lot of time of spending time telling you about his background. I want you to hear his songs. They're very strong, scriptural songs that will inspire you. And as we begin this new year, and we see everything that's happening around us, we need to just be in touch with our Lord. And we need to know His grace in a supernatural way as we begin 2017. And this is Phil Wickham with a song called This is Amazing Grace, right now on the cross in the desert. Let's listen. amazing, incredible Christian music of Paul Wickham, and that is something called This Is Amazing Grace. One of the things that I always, when the new year comes, I always think very deeply about recommitting my life to prayer, because we get so preoccupied. If we would understand that prayer is like breathing, that we can't do without very long, then we would be more of a praying people. And I really believe that no matter how many books I write, no matter how many radio programs I do, while all of that is good, prayer is absolutely central, because God chooses in His sovereignty to use our prayers to shape history. And if we believed that, we would be more of a praying people. And I say all of that to say this next song by Phil Wickham is about that subject of prayer in the secret place. And it's called that because there is that time when we go to our quote-unquote secret place to pray and seek the Lord. This is once again Phil Wickham and The Secret Place.
Couldn't last for more.
Music of Phil Wickham, The Secret Place, in a duet, and it's a song about prayer. That's the vital link we as Christians have. Prayer is like breathing. We really, really can't do without it. Have one more song here from Phil, and it is very good. It's called Your Love Awakens Me Right Now, featuring his music today on The Cross in the Desert. Let's listen. That awakens me. Some great Christian music this morning on The Cross in the Desert. In my remaining minutes here, I want to feature the book segment and let you know what's going on in my life of writing. Currently, I'm writing a brand new novel, something really distinct and different from anything I've written. I usually write about Islam, Iran, and human rights. This novel is different. It's a Christian worldview novel, title I give it. It's called Full Moon Over Loch Ness, and it's the story of an atheist. a skeptic. He's not an ornery one. He's a nice guy, but he's very firm in his beliefs. And he will meet a young, crippled, I should say, Christian girl in Scotland as he goes there to investigate a serial killer and the Loch Ness Monster. And his world is going to be just absolutely revolutionized by this friendship. So I don't want to give a whole lot more of the details away, but I promise you, I write books with the Christian worldview in focus because that's the most important thing. And so that is my current novel, but I'm also helping my dear friend Paymaneh. Paymaneh is an Iranian Christian refugee. She's a friend that writes for this program, Stories About Iran and Human Rights, and she is writing her life story, actually, as a refugee. It's a book called Stories from Exile, The Life of an Iranian Refugee. And she's going to talk about her life growing up in Iran before and after the revolution and how that changed her life, how she ended up leaving and going to another country. And she is presently waiting for that all-important interview with UNHCR in order to go to a country where there's total freedom, like here. In Malaysia, it is an Islamic country. It's not a very safe place for for Shia Muslims. And even though Paymaneh is a Christian, she comes from a country that's Shiite Muslims. And so the Sunnis in Malaysia are very antagonistic toward the Shia Muslims. And even though, like I mentioned, Paymaneh is a Christian, just because she came from Iran, which is Shia, there's that conflict there. So it's not a very friendly country to Shia Muslims, as well as Christians. And so she's in a place, even though she's living in a Christian community, she's in a place where there is not a lot of freedom, and she needs to find a new country. But my point is, I'm helping her with her story, editing it, making recommendations and things like that. So two books are coming up here in the spring. One is the one I'm writing by myself, and the one I'm co-authoring and editing with Paymaneh. I really am excited about this book for Paymaneh because it's going to put a face on all Iranian refugees. You will learn from Paymaneh's experience a good idea of what it's like for Iranian refugees all over the world who are struggling. And there are some communities where they're not given good, adequate medical care, where the conditions are pretty deplorable, and it's a long waiting list to get that interview, to get a visa, to get out. I know I have some Iranian friends who are now in Turkey. I have one in particular. Her name is Elham, and she is close to getting that important interview to go forward and to leave. And her heart and soul is to come here to live in the United States because in Los Angeles, where she wants to go, it's a strong Iranian community there, a lot of Iranians there. And so understand, she's leaving Iran. She has to. She's living in Turkey now. She wants to go where there's freedom. She's a Christian. And the reason she's there is she was part of the house church movement. She actually had a meeting in her home with the house church, and it was soon discovered that the police found out about it. So she fled, and she did the right thing, because if not, she'd be in prison. Because in Iran, if you're a Muslim that converts from Islam to Christianity, you can face the death penalty. So I'm really excited about this book with Paymaneh, because I know it's going to really inform and educate all of us about the plight of Iranian refugees. But I just want to take a couple of minutes here in the new year to just recommit my dedication to my Iranian friends. I know today we've talked a lot about Israel, and so I want to come back to focus on what is my heart's desire, and that is Iran. The book I have in my hand is a story of my Iranian friends. It's their stories. In this book, I edited and published in a book called The Cross in the Desert, Speaking Hope and Freedom to Iran. This is from 2 years ago. On the front cover is a picture of Rahane Jabari. It was right after this book was published that she was executed, and I knew then I had to write her story, and I'm just thrilled that this time last year I was in the middle of writing Rahane, A Beautiful Fragrance, which was published in March of last year and is doing very well and really going to be a book that is going to put a face on Iranian women, what they go through living in Iran. Rahane was tortured and executed for defending herself against a rape attack by a former intelligence agent with the government. And it's a story that will break your heart, but through this story, you will learn about the status of women in Iran and what they face for living there. And it's a story that I'm just thrilled to have had the opportunity to meet with family online, to talk with them, to translate many of Rahane's prison letters, to use that information in my book. My good friend Paymane assisted me. She would take some of the stories from from Rahane's mother, Sholeh. Sholeh doesn't know English really well. She would translate that for me into English, and I incorporated it into the book. And so it's a faithful book, tells the story of Rahane. But what I wanted to do in my remaining minutes was to read to you a prayer from this book, The Cross in the Desert, which is a book that needs to be updated because a couple of my friends in there, their lives have dramatically changed. And in my first chapter of this book, I have a dear friend named Maral who left Shiraz, Iran, about a year and a half ago and came to Germany with the refugees that left Iran. She traveled by boat and on foot. And as she entered into Germany to get processed, she also became a Christian. It's a wonderful story. It needs to be updated. In fact, I'm meeting with her right after the broadcast today. I'm going to take down the details of her journey from Iran to Germany, and I'm going to rewrite that story that's in this book, actually, when she lived in Shiraz. But there is a scripture in this book that I stand by and pray for my Iranian friends every day. And I wanted to read that to you so you can understand why I pray it. This is a Bible verse from the book of Psalms, Psalm 72, in fact. And it is a wonderful promise that shows the character and the heart of who God really is. And I want you to listen to this. This is why I put it in the book. Psalm 72, verse 12 says, David speaking of God, he will rescue the poor when they cry to him. He will help the oppressed who have no one to defend them. He feels pity for the weak and the needy, and he will rescue them. He will redeem them from oppression and violence, for their lives are precious to him. It's a beautiful promise that's in the foreword to my book, The Cross in the Desert. This literally is a prayer every day for me to my dear friends in Iran, to Arash and Golrakh, to Nazanin, the British UK dual citizen that is suffering in prison in Iran, to Roya, another British Iranian dual citizen suffering in prison in Iran, to many, many of those that I know that are suffering, this is a promise and a prayer from God. He will rescue the poor when they cry to him. You see, that's the character of God. He is all good and all loving, but we have to cry out to him. He will help the oppressed simply because there's no one to defend them. And many of my Iranian friends feel not only oppressed but depressed. They feel like no one is on their side. No one is there to defend them. But ultimately God is. It says something of the character of God in his emotions. He feels pity for the weak and needy. And it promises to rescue them. And it says in the most beautiful words possible, he will redeem them. That is, buy them back out of slavery. He will rescue them from oppression and violence, for their lives are precious to him. Don't doubt for 1 minute that our God knows what's going on with Arash and Golrakh. He understands their pain. And I can say that because God became man in Jesus. And Jesus suffered a humiliating death for our sins. He understands pain. No other God in the universe. There is only one God, but no other religious teaching about God in the universe has a God that comes into humanity in human flesh and understands and feels and experiences our pain like our God does. And our God understands hurt. He understands pain. He understands brokenness. And that's why when I look at this scripture, I can believe it, because he will ultimately rescue them. He will ultimately deliver them in one way or another. That's his choosing how he does it. In some cases, he does it through death. In some cases, he does it physically. But our God is faithful. I know I have prayed. I know that many of my Christian friends join me in praying for my Iranian friends. And what I want to do in this new year, and I say this to you, I want to recommit and rededicate all of my being, all of my energy, all of my passion to being a voice of hope and freedom to my Iranian friends. And I have many friends that join with me that are just wonderful representatives of hope. One is Ani Cyrus. Ani Cyrus is a wonderful, dedicated soldier, a voice of hope and freedom for Iranians. Kaveh Tahiri, my human rights activist, Miriam Zazdi, Shabnam Asadali, all of them speak out for the Iranians' hope and freedom and for human rights. And so I join with them in one voice. And I have a new friend that I'm very excited about, Jalal Stratham. She is a voice of hope educating us about the terrors and the oppression of Islam. And I thank her for joining me in this great adventure of speaking out and educating people about this subject. I want to thank everyone who came to the chat room today. I want to thank you, Uzay and Ava and Jalal and anyone else who came to listen to the program today. I want to say Happy New Year to every one of you. Have a blessed and prosperous new year. And I will see you again Thursday on the Cross in the Desert. Have a great week.
Glory, glory.